Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Good evening. You are listening to Interchange on WFHB. I'm your host this evening, Allison Bechtesh, and here with me in the studio is Bloomington's own Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor. Dr. Taylor, thank you so much for joining me this evening.
Thanks, Allison. I really appreciate it.
The Brain Extravaganza is well underway. 22 of the most exquisitely decorated brains are currently residing in Bloomington. Here I go, the brainchild, and I can't wait for puns all night long, but the brainchild of Jill Bolte Taylor, Brain Resources and Innovative Neurological Solutions, Inc. That's JBT Brains, Inc., Dr. Taylor's nonprofit organization, and educational services promoting awareness of brain issues, appreciation for the brain, education about the brain. We're going to talk about the Brain Extravaganza, and we're going to get to that. I think they look fantastic. They're all over town, but I want to give a little context to why their brains and what they're doing there. And so for the briefest of biographies, Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor is a native Hoosier. She's a Harvard-trained and published neuroanatomist and has served on the board of directors of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, has taught at universities throughout Indiana, and is the author of My Stroke of Insight, an autobiography about experiencing and recovering from a stroke. The book went on the New York Times bestseller list, and the 18-minute lecture at the TED conference in 2008 has become one of the most watched of all of the prestigious TED Talks of all time. So I'm going to begin by playing just a small couple of clips from that TED Talk, an account of what it was like to experience the stroke as it happened.
Super.
At first, I was shocked to find myself inside of a silent mind. But then I was immediately captivated by the magnificence of the energy around me. And because I could no longer identify the boundaries of my body, I felt enormous and expansive. I felt at one with all the energy that was, and it was beautiful there. And then all of a sudden, my left hemisphere comes back online and it says to me, hey, we got a problem, we got a problem, we got to get some help. And I'm going, oh, I got a problem, I got a problem. So it's like, okay, I got a problem. But then I immediately drifted right back out. And in that moment, my right arm went totally paralyzed by my side. Then I realized, oh my gosh, I'm having a stroke. And then the next thing my brain says to me is, wow, this is so cool. This is so cool. How many brain scientists have the opportunity to study their own brain from the inside out? And then it crosses my mind, but I'm a very busy woman. I don't have time for a stroke.
All right. Well, I like that clip a lot, as I was saying, because the humor involved. And this is not an easy subject and not an easy experience to go through. And there's humor in the book, too, which I appreciated. But definitely watching you up there and speaking, you go through a lot of emotions. And you get to the point where you talk about being resigned to death as you're in the ambulance. And the beauty of what happens thereafter as you recover. So you've recounted that morning so many times. One thing that I was curious about as reading about the story and hearing you talk about it, how much of that is an actual memory mm-hmm. in the way that we remember, you know, what we had for breakfast yesterday morning, and how much of that is kind of reconstructed or out of body experience? You know that this happened to you. Mm-hmm. Is there a differential between that memory and our general memories?
What happened for me was I lost language. And in the absence of language in my left brain, I gained this right hemisphere, right here, right now experience, which is essentially a video. It's the visual that we run of our reality. And when I lost language, all I really had was the video. And so I actually worked with a local Gestalt therapist here in Bloomington, who's no longer with us, in order to react out the morning of the stroke and to add language to it. And I did that within the first year following the stroke. And I knew that I had to recount my experience before I had new memories, before my left brain came back online, had new language and wanted to tell a different story. So when I went to this woman, we spent an entire weekend and we videotaped the experience, and I acted out the morning of the stroke, and she helped me apply language to it. So the recount in the book, even though the book didn't come out until 8 years later, I had written that original section of the morning of the stroke early on for exactly that reason. I wanted it to be as pure as I could reenact that visually.
That's fascinating. It makes me think of post-traumatic stress disorders or other ways of, you know, therapy of getting through something like that. And then you just mentioned an 8-year recovery process. Right. So putting you, you know, fully recovered, though I don't think any of us can really classify as ourselves as that from any experience. Mm-hmm. This was in 1996.
Yeah.
So 2004, is my math right? 8 years later that you feel that whole again.
Right.
And then you're mentioning this right brain, left brain thing, so I want to get right to that. I mean, one of the coolest things I think about brains is that they can think about themselves.
Exactly.
So, that we're using our brains to talk about this now, and anyone listening is thinking mm-hmm. about their own brain and your brain, and that's just such an amazing ability of our brain. Can you just start by telling us those two factors of the brain and what they represent and how they communicate with each other?
Sure. The brain is divided into two primary hemispheres. The right hemisphere is right now processing all of our sensory information, everything we're seeing, smelling, tasting. It's creating this enormous collage, this explosion of what this present moment is like. And so it remembers without language, but it's experiential, and it has this visual video essentially that's running. So it's all about the right here, right now. And then the left hemisphere takes that right here, right now data and processes it in some kind of a sequence. It gives us linearity to our thinking so that our left brain actually has the capacity to think in words, to think in language. It's the voice that's always speaking to us. It has a past. It has a future. And it processes that information in a different way so that between the two hemispheres, we have this amazing ability to consciously choose where we put our mind. Do we bring our mind to the present moment experience, which can be devoid of past thought or future thought, or we can put it in the left hemisphere and process information from another time, another place. It's a beautiful combination, and we're all designed to have both of them working constantly at the same time for everything in our information processing. So, you know, how nice that we have both.
I'm glad you mentioned that because while reading your book, I think I started being very much like, you know, team right brain, team left brain, you know, like, and yeah. I think a lot of people do gravitate towards one yeah. or the other in their sensibilities, but you notice once you have that combination that you get the fullest effect of both, that you're able to do all that experience and then put it into context.
Exactly. Well, to me, the whole message is about balance. We have these two beautiful hemispheres, and when you look at our typical society, we are skewed to the values of the left brain. And, you know, a really successful life, in my opinion, a really successful, healthy brain is one that capitalizes on the skill sets of both simultaneously, all the time, using both skill sets and not being ashamed or have confidence between the two. And you have to consider that when you're in the right here, right now experience, you're having a feeling. It feels joyful. It feels curious. There's a personality that goes with that. And then there's the left brain personality, which has a completely different character. So in my opinion, the first most important relationship any of us has is the relationship between the two characters in our two hemispheres. And some of us, we really like each of us. And some of us, our left brain may be hostile or belittle the character of the right brain because it doesn't live up to the same set of values. And the right hemisphere doesn't have language, so it can't defend itself very well. But one of the beautiful things that a local surgeon, one of my good friends, Jerry Jessup, always says is the other always knows. The other always knows. So whether or not that right brain consciousness is actually verbalizing something or not, it knows whether you're telling the truth. It knows if you're being deceptive. It knows if you're scheming. So ultimately, we both really need to create peace between the two of them.
And the clip that we heard earlier, you were in this great moment of you refer to it later as La La Land, your hemorrhage, your stroke was in your left brain. Mm-hmm. And so it did allow for the first time that right brain to take over, or to be the only form of a sense that you were getting. And I think that's very significant. And as we go on to talk about, you know, the arts project that you put on in Bloomington, I think that it's very significant that that's a right brain kind of project. So just to take an aside for a moment, and you also said in your book that most, the higher percentage of strokes happen in the left side of the brain. But if they happen in the right side of the brain, do you get to that kind of free, live in the moment feeling, or what all of a sudden takes over? Do you know that?
Well, I of course didn't personally experience that, but I have received emails from individuals who have had that experience, and they generally report that they can't get away from the details. And I've had several people say to me they can't find God. Because if the right hemisphere is our ability to look at the bigger picture, look at everything as one collective whole, to get out of the details and get out of the boundaries and the rules and the rights and the wrongs and the goods and the bads, when you leave that behind, you become more expansive and more open. And so if you lose that more expansive and open perspective, then what that leaves you with is the ability to really process detail, more details about those details, judgment about those details, constantly critically analyzing everything. And my guess is it's not quite as pleasant an experience as what I experienced.
And you also said these two personalities that you have to recognize and matched, the quote you gave from your friend. So did your personality in fact change because of this incident?
Well, I shifted back into being much more right brain, much more right here and now. When I was in high school, I was voted class clown. You know, I was joyful. I was always having a good time. I was very athletic, very in my body, very aware of the present and happy. Then I came to IU and I became scholastic. Well, that's what's supposed to happen. I fell in love with anatomy. And so I just wanted to learn all the details about the body, details of anatomy. And it was now my fascination. And, you know, my mother is just so grateful that I finally grew up to use my mind. But it was really the development of my left brain. And then I achieved well and moved on to a PhD and then on to Harvard and was climbing the ladder that the left brain really values. And I was doing really well, winning all the awards. And then I woke up one day and had this major hemorrhage that wiped out that left brain and that whole skill set of that way of thinking, and in the absence of that, shifted back really into the character whom I had been when I was younger. So I was really comfortable as that person. You know, one day I was a Harvard doctor, and the next day I was a lump. My mother describes me as a breathing body in the bed, and I was okay with that because the present moment experience is one that deserves to be celebrated. And even in that condition, because I didn't have the left brain judgment that said, well, I am less than I used to be, in the absence of that, I was alive. I was still alive, capable of having this information processing experience of oh my gosh, you know, this wonder of life. So I felt grateful that I hadn't died that day.
Absolutely. I want to talk a little bit about your recovery process and some of these things that you were involved in before you had your stroke that you attribute to being a big part of your success. The brain bank jingle, the work that you were doing in the brain bank and getting more donations for brain tissue, and NAMI, both these organizations, you had already been put out there. You didn't lectures. And so there's people who knew you that you didn't necessarily know. And these letters were coming in from all these people. And this was something you couldn't even read, but tactile. You could feel that support. So can you talk a little bit about those organizations that you're involved in and how they helped you through this?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the Harvard Brain Bank is a wonderful organization, one of the best kept secrets. What we do is we acquire brain tissue from people who have recently passed and then process that tissue and distribute that to eligible scientists throughout the country so that they can do their research. So that way, if I'm a scientist in Indiana, I'm studying postmortem schizophrenia, then I don't have to to go out and collect my own tissue, I can go to the brain bank and request that tissue. So it's a wonderful resource, but there's always been a long-term shortage of brain tissue donated for research into the severe mental illnesses, as well as a shortage of tissue from people who would be classified as normal control. So those are individuals who don't have either a neurological or neuropsychiatric illness in their family. So it's a wonderful resource. At the same time, it's one of the best kept secrets, because the brain bank, although they're given funding to acquire tissue, process it, and distribute it, they are not given any funding for education about them and what they do and about the need. So I took it upon myself to go out and educate families with severe mental illness through the NAMI network nationally. And you start talking about brain donation and people are looking at you like, oh my gosh, she wants my brain. And it's like, well, yes, I do. But don't worry, I'm in no hurry. And so in order to lighten it up and make it palatable, I wrote the Brain Bank jingle and started singing this at all of my gigs. And it was successful. And we started donations. Before I started, we were receiving 1, 2, maybe 3 brains from individuals with a psychiatric diagnosis a year. I mean, that's not enough tissue for our lab, much less all the labs in the country that wanted the tissue. And we got up to 25 to 35 brains a year. But realistically, the medical community could use 100, 200 brains a year from the psychiatrically diagnosed, as well as the normal control population, in order to really get an understanding of the biology underlying what is schizophrenia, what is bipolar, what is OCD, what is panic and anxiety, what is the biological. And once we understand that compared to normal, then medications can be created in order to really stimulate the circuitry and help.
Fantastic. We do have to go to a break here. I am speaking with Dr. Jill Bolte-Taylor. We spoke a little bit about your stroke. I really want to talk about the recovery process and what lessons you learned that can actually be applied to anyone with a brain, luckily, and then move on to our brain exhibit right here in Bloomington. So stay with us here on Interchange.
Support for WFHB comes from The Breeze Bends the Grass, a brand new theatrical musical written by and starring Arbutus Cunningham and Krista DeTour, debuting at the Brown County Playhouse in Nashville, Indiana, Memorial Day weekend, May 25th and 26th. This world premiere will raise funds for the Brown County Art Guild, home to Marie Goth's estate collection of paintings by early 20th century Indiana artists, and also featuring the works of 50 contemporary member artists. For more information, you can visit browncountyartguild.org. That's Brown County Art Guild, all one word, .org.
You are listening to Interchange on WFHB. I'm Allison Bechtesh, and I'm speaking with Dr. Jill Bolte-Taylor, who has had the unique experience of becoming her own research subject as a brain scientist who experienced a stroke. I do want to go on to the recovery process. Is there anything else you want to add about your pre-stroke life or the day of your stroke before we move on to that recovery?
I did my undergraduate here at IU, and I love Bloomington.
Wonderful. And I can't wait to talk more about Bloomington and art in Bloomington as we talk about the brain extravaganza. So those 22 highly decorated brains that you have seen around Bloomington this spring. So let's talk about the recovery process. I mean, the stroke, it was 4 hours that you went from the stroke waking up with a bad headache to in the ambulance on the way to the hospital and into the ICU. So then starts recovery. Mm-hmm. You didn't die.
I didn't die.
And you woke up and realized that. And from then on, and what you describe as an 8-year process, coming back to Jill again, or mm-hmm. Jill part two. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk a little bit. Mother's Day was on Sunday, and your mother, it was such a crucial part of your healing. And it's kind of a two-part question. I would love for you to talk about that relationship with your mother. You mm-hmm. say kind of that she was able to mother you twice, that she right. gave birth to you, of course. But then, as you said a moment ago, you're like an infant, mm-hmm. a breathing bag of human, mm-hmm. you know, no speech ability, no motor skills. So you can this discussion with your own mother, but also just the importance of a stroke patient having someone around all the time that is that patient with them and willing and dedicated. You said if you hadn't had your mom there, the typical recovery process is to be in a room with a television.
Right. You know, I was very, very fortunate. My mother, I was the baby of three, two older brothers, so they were a handful. And so by the time I came along, you know, she was a very busy woman. She was the wife of a preacher man. She was a full-time professor over at ISU. So she was a busy girl. And I was born, very fortunately, happy. And so, you know, I was just kind of here and kind of joyful, and life was good. But round two, she, you know, when I had that stroke, she got to come back and mother me really from infancy again. So she describes me as a breathing body in the bed. And that, of course, was a shock to her because the doctors had told her that I was stable. And so that she thought that meant I would be sitting up and talking, or at least sitting up and having some conscious awareness. And it was clear that I was not capable of any information processing. So it was a new beginning. And she's a very smart woman, and she's always been fascinated with language and what is or mathematics. And what is mathematics? Is it a language? And the whole developmental process. And so she kind of got to use me as, you know, her own interest and observation. And what she discovered was that if she allowed me to sleep as long as I wanted to sleep, then when I would awake, then I was attentive, and she would feed me, take me to the restroom. And if I had any energy left over, then she would help me out, give me something to do. She acted as a guard at the door. She didn't let just anybody come in. If people did come in, they came in for short spurts of 5 to 10 minutes. The rule pretty much was you bring your positive energy, you pay conscious attention to what you're bringing me, no woe is me, no woe is Jill, you know, just none of the negative affect, take responsibility for the energy you bring in. And because that's what I was sensitive to. And so she was the guard at the door who really protected me. And without her love and her support, there's no question in my mind that if I were placed into a typical facility where I was given amphetamines in the morning to wake up my brain, and then taken out and put into a stimulation of a room where there's noise and there's a TV in my face, and that I would not be in the condition that I'm in today. So I was really very blessed that not only did I survive that day, and I would like to add that, you know, people say, you know, how could you be so positive about it? How can you be so positive? And the bottom line for me was I survived. I lived. I did not die that day. And I was always grateful for that because I came so close to death and essentially felt my own spirit surrender and said goodbye to my body, not thinking I'd ever be able to get it to budge again. And so first just to have survived, and then to be in a position with a caregiver who was sensitive to what it might be like for me and what might bring me pain and what did I need in order to thrive again, totally blessed, totally absolutely thrilled for the whole situation. I got lucky.
I should mention that the type of stroke you had, since birth,
arteriovenous malformation.
Thank you.
Yeah, a congenital disorder in the blood vessels in my brain.
And is this something that is typically recoverable from? I mean, I put a note down. Mm-hmm. I think you went back to work faster than, you know, maternity leave in France after brain surgery. Was that expected once you did get stabilized, yeah, you know, as mediocre as that may have been? Is that the typical path that you just relearn everything and then you're up and walking, or is this a rare case?
Well, it's a pretty rare case. First of all, it's a rare form of stroke. So something like, I think just 13% or something like that of strokes are hemorrhagic.
Okay.
So it was a major hemorrhage. If you survive, the death rate is high with a hemorrhage. If you survive, then it depends on where the hemorrhage happened. I was fortunate, believe it or not, that all I did was lose my mind, half of my mind. I still had the other half, and I was happy about that. If it would have happened in my brainstem area, then it would have been more life-threatening sooner. If I would have been left alone for another half hour to an hour, I'm sure I wouldn't have been here today. So the timing worked out well for me. So the recovery has been described as, of course, miraculous or remarkable, which simply to me means that we don't understand why it happened or how it happened, but it happened. And I have some opinions about what we did in order to set the brain cells up for success in the recovery process. And there are a lot of things that you can do to get in your own way, emotionally. You can get in your way of not getting enough sleep, not feeding yourself the right things, not getting enough exercise, or overdoing it instead of really balancing that out with adequate amount of sleep in order to recover. So we obviously did recovery right. It took at least 8 years for that process to happen. But after 8 years, I was back to teaching at the medical school level. I was back to teaching kinesiology here in Bloomington. It's got to happy ending.
And then I have to ask again, your memories of this recovery process as you're learning to speak again, so you mm-hmm. don't have those words, you can't tell the story using words, are those also graphic kind of video movie moments that you're lying in bed and your mom's taking care of you, or you're putting together that puzzle? Is that a visual memory?
It's what I would call experiential, because I don't just have the picture of it, but I have the experience of what it felt like in my body as I held those pieces of puzzle in my hands, looking at them, having no understanding that an insie goes into an outsie piece. And I remember the moment my mother said, color. You can use color as a clue. And it was like, whoa, color. And what's color? And then, you know, what that felt like inside of my body to realize color and have essentially that circuit come online. So it was a growing. It was the circuits that were there were working pretty well, relatively speaking. It was then a matter of what circuits were offline, which then I had to be reintroduced to in order to re-engage with their function. And then once I opened that file again and I had that information, then I could use that information again. And so I was in a constant state of growth and redevelopment. And most of the circuits in my brain survived. They were traumatized, but they survived, and I had to relearn everything from scratch, particularly my language, particularly my anatomy and my area of expertise, particularly my memories of my past. But overall, I was making such big strides every day that the progress was notable. And then I started making lists once I could write again on my door. So over the course of 8 years, I wrote things that I was getting back and the date for when I got those back. And it was after 8 years then when I felt as though my body was a solid again. What that meant was this group of cells in my left parietal region that define the boundaries of where I begin and where I end, they were functional again. And those were one of the first things that left me. And the way neurology generally works is if you have a trauma, the first thing, symptom that you have is the last thing that you actually recover. So when I felt that I was a solid again, then I felt that's when I decided I was completely recovered.
That's fantastic. And you do talk about water skiing on Lake Monroe here. Mm-hmm. I cannot even water ski on the Nintendo Wii. So it blows my mind that you weren't able to move your body and you can get there. So what you also tell this story about just trying to sit up, you know, and it's things that we don't think about unless you've ever had to try and do that. I mean, thousands of tries just to make that rocking motion, not to sit up, just to do that step one. And so I wanted to ask you at first, you know, what was one of the keys? And you do say, you know, to try and try again. Mm-hmm. And I would think that any one of us knows that, but then that right. takes an extra step to actually do that. And one thing you attribute that extra step to is that you knew you were in this position to teach, mm-hmm. that you were understanding what your brain was going through, and that you could bring that those lessons to other people, even if you hadn't had a stroke. So that's really what I want to focus on now. Mm-hmm. You knew the difference between the right side and the left side and what you were using with the right side of your brain. And you talked a little bit earlier about just kind of choosing to hone in on one. So is that capable? Can you, if you haven't had the left side mm-hmm. of your brain destroyed, is it still capable to make your decisions based on deciding to be here and now or mm-hmm. deciding to be all details?
Well, you make the choice all the time. I mean, when something happens in your environment and it catches your attention, you are in the present moment experience, you know, watching something. Let's say a deer comes out from behind a bush. Well, most of us find deer to be beautiful. And so, you know, you bring your attention and you watch it. You consciously can be aware that you're bringing your mind to the present moment. You also know when you're daydreaming. You know, whenever I present, I always say to my audience, okay, who in the audience is bold and brave enough to tell me you're not paying attention? Because our minds wander. I will say something that will spark an association. Your mind is naturally designed to follow that association. It takes you away from this present moment of listening to what I have to say. You've wandered off, and then your frontal lobe comes back online and says appropriateness of behavior, bring it back, and you come back and you start paying attention again. We have the ability to choose where our minds are at, and it's just this absolutely phenomenal experience that we all take for granted. We don't all take for granted, but many of us do. And so we have the choice about at what time period is our mind. And on top of that, we're not like trees where we're stuck in one position and the stimulation coming to our nervous system has to come to us. We have the ability to consciously choose where are we going to take our nervous system, what environment are we going to put our nervous system in order to receive or to give output to. And so we're constantly making the judgment, is this something positive that attracts me or is this something negative that repels me? And, you know, we own our power as human beings. We make those choices all the time. I just do it in a really conscious way. And a lot of people study what they call mindfulness and they do it in a very conscious way as well.
You referred to the moment during your stroke as you're going in and out, those moments of nirvana, I mean, of absolute peace. Mm-hmm. And again, that's not something that you're wishing upon anyone mm-hmm. to get there in that way through a stroke. Are there other kind of exercises or we can catch ourselves daydreaming, but can we ever control it?
Well, I think people try to control it on a regular basis. When people go into prayer, essentially when you're in prayer, you are connecting, bringing your mind to the present moment, and you're perhaps reciting a prayer over and over again, which preoccupies the language center so that brain chatter or the monkey mind is busy and you can actually go have another experience. The same thing's true for meditation. When we meditate and we're trying to focus on our mind and bring our mind or empty our mind. Well, our mind's never really empty, but it's a matter of which circuitry inside of our brain are we trying to run. And we're trying really then to get away from the language center, which is bringing up all the past or bringing up negative stuff or even bringing up positive stuff that is somewhere other than the right here, right now experience. Some of us go into nature, and when you go into nature and you allow your eyes to go to the bigger picture, to go out into the distance, to stop focusing on the detail, to start paying attention to how does the humidity, which is really easy to do in Bloomington, how does the humidity feel in your lungs? How does it feel against the skin? How does it feel against the hair on your arms? You know, what does the air feel like? What does it feel like to actually breathe in that amount of humidity? I'm one of those people that I love it. You know, I'm happy Hoosier in Bloomington in the summer. I love the humidity. When I went to Boston, the air is generally dry. And then when humidity would come in, everybody would wilt. And I'm all of a sudden out there, oh, just feeling it, just really being invigorated. So we're making these choices constantly. Some of us do it consciously. Some of us aren't paying any attention to it. But the fact of the matter is we have the ability to think about it if we want to.
And it was during these times in your story that I started, you know, being team right brain, that you can get into this very accepting mind frame, you know, choosing not to dwell on something for more than just that that anger instinct of 90 seconds, choosing to then let that go. And the right brain, as we know, it is the more artistic side. Saying you had your jingle was how you connected with people even before the stroke. You were using art in that way. And then a big project that you worked on to help recover was the Stained Glass Brain, this art project. So can you, let's lead into the next segment talking about our Bloomington art project, which is kind of a general answer from you for how important is art?
Oh, well, you know, to me, art is the creative expression of our brain. And it's not just a right brain experience. Art requires really utilizing both. But what art does is it allows us to get out of the right and the wrong. As soon as you get out of right and wrong and you're allowing yourself to just have an experience, to just express something without that level of judgment, then it becomes really a healthy creative process. And the more you do a technique, then of course you're going to have judgment in because you're going to want to be able to perfect it or to get better at it or to create an association between this way of being and that way of being and using different media. But it's the willingness to be wrong. And it's you know, and it's really not about wrong. It's just the willingness to do something for the sake of doing it. The Brain Extravaganza is an enormous project. And it was, for me, it was really very right brain and left brain because I've been dealing with details for literally 2 years. And, you know, once the launch happened, then for me, it was like my left brain got to, you know, I gave the gift. I gave the gift to the community, and it's not mine anymore. Now it's what we do with it and how we treat it and how we judge it and protect it and use it and have fun with it. You know, these brains, in my opinion, the brains are absolutely gorgeous. The artists showed up 1,000%, and they've just done a lovely job.
All right, well, all about the Brain Extravaganza after the break. You are listening to Interchange. I'm Allison Bechtesh, and we have Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor here in the studio with us.
Support for WFHB comes from the River Roots Music and Folk Arts Festival in historic Madison, Indiana. On Friday, May 18th through Sunday, May 20th, a three-day festival featuring musicians, storytellers, folk artists, family activities, a craft brew festival, and a variety of food and beverage vendors. Tickets and information available at visitmadison.org.
On Interchange on WFHB, I'm your host tonight, Allison Bechtesh. Here in the studio with me is Bloomington's own Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor. And we're going to talk about the Brain Extravaganza. If you have gone anywhere in Bloomington recently, you have seen a massive brain. I think it's taller and longer than I am, somewhere around it, and prettier than the one that you held up during your TED Talk, which made me squeamish, as fascinated as I am by brain. So I want to talk about those. I want to begin this segment just by pointing out my favorite page in your book. It is page 132. And you start out by saying, I wanted to move home back to Indiana. You were working at Harvard when this all happened, living in Boston and recovering But you do have this sentence, my favorite place on earth is Bloomington, Indiana. And that is the one part of the book I was absolutely able to completely bond with and agree with you 100%. You know, not a lot of the rest of it have I experienced, but I love that. So let's gush about Bloomington for a moment here. And how you came to come home to Bloomington and maybe talk a little bit about the art scene or the community that was willing to have a project like the Brain Extravaganza.
Well, you know, when I came back from Harvard, the nice thing about being at Harvard is everybody goes to Harvard as a stepping stone, and then from there you can pretty much go where you want to go. And so when I left there, I was wide open to, I didn't know what the future would hold. And if I could live anywhere on earth, I wanted to live in Bloomington. And I considered living in Indianapolis, but I knew that if I moved to Indy, I would become more political. And if I moved to Bloomington, I would become more creative. And I thought, creative trumps. So I'm in Bloomington and have been here since 97. And I just love it. So this is home for me. And in trying to find my way and navigate my life through the process of recovery, recovery meant going back to IU and teaching again and regaining my scholastic ability. And then the TED Talk hit. Well, then I wrote the book, and then the TED Talk hit. And once the TED Talk hit and Time 100 hit and everything hit, the Oprah hit in 2008, you know, I just went on this incredible whirlwind. I called 2008 as the tsunami of my life. It was as powerful as the stroke had been, but you know, at the opposite extreme of wow, as opposed to whoa. So it was. It's been a wild ride. So for 4 years now, I've been managing my system and trying to figure out, because you know, all of a sudden you got to have people. Well, I don't even know what kind of people you got to get, much less where do you find people. So I now have my system, my machines in place. I think I'm ready pretty much for what happens. I have a grasp on my time. My energy's 1,000% go, go, go. I'm back to water skiing on Lake Monroe. Makes me very happy. So you know, it's like, how do I bring what I care about and nurture this community and bring the community along for the ride that I'm on? Because, you know, there's going to be this movie. There's just no reason for Bloomington to not be in the spotlight with me. So the Brain Extravaganza was an introduction of Bloomington to Jill Bolte Taylor Brains, my new not-for-profit, which cares about education, appreciation, and awareness of the human brain. So I went to the city and said, you know, how would you feel about this? And they said, well, maybe we'll make a committee and talk about it. And it was like, well, that's a step in the right direction. So 2 years later, we've got brains all over the city and all over campus. And personally, I'm just thrilled. You know, I drive by, these people are reading them, they're talking, they're reading them out loud to one another. People are learning the brain facts. They're playing the phone app game. They're engaging. They're uploading their painted brains from the phone game up to Facebook. They're comparing their brains with the celebrities we have on the site. People are really enjoying it. So it's been great.
That's fantastic. I want to talk about that process. Let's talk a little bit about the inspiration. Other cities have done public art projects similar, and I'm guessing this is where you got the idea. I saw pigs in Seattle and cows in Chicago. Right. Again, showing my bias, Bloomington trumps it all with decorated brains. But how did you even develop that idea?
Well, I saw cows in Chicago, and it was like, wow, cows on street corners. And I'm thinking, whoa, imagine what it'd be like to have big brains everywhere, big brains. And so that, you know, that was the beginning. And it took many years for me to certainly manifest this. And fortunately, the city was willing to cooperate and to play along. And as our mayor says, it was a no-brainer. And, and you know, we've just been the jokes, the brain jokes.
I'm glad we got another pun in there.
Exactly. But people are talking brains. They're thinking about their brains. Even if they're complaining about them, they're still talking about brains. You know, even there's been some abuse going on with some of the brains. Well, you know, that's typical of part of the brain. So of course we expect that. You know, it's certainly not what we want to call the normal, but it is a part of who we are as a society, and it's an expression of our brains. So it's to be expected. So, you know, it's for me, it's just been fabulous.
So let's talk about the loads and loads of work. Looking at this, you mentioned the city, which I hadn't even put on the list here, because I paired at least three groups for each of the 22 brains. Mm-hmm. We have a sponsor for each one, right. an artist for each one, mm-hmm. a location for each one, and mm-hmm. so those three are not necessarily related, plus right. the tons and tons of volunteers right. that came in and put their time right. in all the other aspects. Can you right. touch on each one of those?
Oh, yeah. Well, we wouldn't be here if it weren't for the city. The city said yes. We went to IU, and IU said yes. And then we went to the business community and said, we need sponsors, and they said yes. We felt that 12 would be enough, but we got 22. Then we went to the artist community, and they said yes. We went to the volunteers and said, we need help, and so they said yes. And it's been great. And I have to say, my project manager, Michael Shermis, none of this would have manifested the way that it has, as beautifully as it has, if it hadn't been for him, because this is a perfect kind of project for him to manage. And it's just been great. So between the two of us, we've got this incredible energy, and, you know, we work it out together, and then he makes magic happen. So the whole community really has participated, and without any of those factors, it wouldn't be as smooth as it has been.
And you do have a map online, and you mentioned the game. You know, we have social media involved, so people can go find the locations of all these brains, just in case someone who is listening hasn't actually gotten to see one of these brains.
Right.
Can you describe the size and material and some of the different ideas that people have run with these brains?
Yeah, we have, they're made out of fiberglass, and they are 5 feet long, 5 feet tall, and 4 feet wide. So they're really enormous. And they are neuroanatomically correct. So all the bumps, the gyri are in the right place. The lines in between the sulci are in the right place. There are even 12 pairs of cranial nerves, which absolutely thrills me. These are neuroanatomically correct brains on display. And so I did a brain. It's at the public library. It's the educational brain for Mechter Lab. And, you know, you expect to go to the library for an education, and so there it is. And all the bumps are labeled, each of the gyri. If you open up any neuro book, the first picture you'll see is a picture of the side of the brain with the bumps labeled. And so all the gyri are labeled on the left side. And then the next page, you're going to have function, a functional map, and which areas of the brain are causing what function. So the right hemisphere looks like that. And then at the front, all 12 pairs of cranial nerves, their number, they're labeled by appropriate name, and then what is their function. So that's the educational brain. Right across the street from that is the Trinity brain. The Trinity brain was a brain sponsored for World Religion by my dad, Hal Taylor, and the artist is Michelle Gingras. And on the left hemisphere is the dogma, the symbols and the names, the labels of the six major world religions. And then on the right hemisphere, all of the same color scheme of the left brain has blown up into pixels, and it looks like confetti, thousands of bits of confetti with the word love, because ultimately all religions, regardless of their details, regardless of their structure, regardless of what they are believing detail-wise, should take us to that experience of the right hemisphere for love. So there's another one. The Wells Library has the one sponsored by NAMI. I'm being very selfish here now that I think about it, but they're the ones at the top of my brain. But it's a bipolar brain. Martina Sellerin did a beautiful job. The left hemisphere represents depression. Oh my gosh, you walk up to this brain and it literally sucks the life out of you. You really, oh my gosh, it's very powerful. And then the right hemisphere represents the euphoria and the mania. So all the brains are very different. There's sculpture, there's kind of a decoupage, there's paint. They're all totally unique. Mary D. Lamantia has one out at the mall, which is for Middleway House. And this brain is, you look inside of it, it's a beautiful brain on the outside, but you look inside of it and there's a sculpture of a human heart with LED lights radiating out to the brain. And so the message is that the consciousness and the rhythm and the love of the brain can help radiate out to our consciousness and help us heal. And then, of course, right outside here, you have your very own WFHB brain by Melissa Johnson. And it's beautiful. She took records that you guys generously donated donated, melted them into the base. Beautiful. There's a great headset. The left brain has lyrics from different words in the right head hemisphere than this joyful experience. So the brains are all very unique, very different from one another. My only criteria for the artist was I wanted it to be neuroanatomically correct. So we discussed at length their design ideas, and then I set them free, and they just did a beautiful, beautiful job. And I have to say, Stonebelt permitted us to create, to use their back warehouse area. And we had 12 brains back there with 10 artists back there working. And so it was like a little artist colony. And all of the artists who were there have talked to us and said, oh my gosh, you know, this was such a wonderful experience. And I have to say, Blooming Foods has just, oh my gosh, shown up for us so much. And we had Bonnie Gordon Lucas do a Blooming Foods brain. And so it's about brain food and what are the foods that are good for your brain. So it's on the Beeline right near Blooming Foods. So it's been wonderful. The community has gathered together and it has just been great.
Well, I think I'm going to sound a little nostalgic or something when I say this, but again, I see you back in your recovery process putting together your stained glass brain and using art as a way when you don't quite have the words or the understanding to still connect. Right. And so JBT Brains with this project, you know, like you said, people are standing in front of these brains and talking about brains, again, using art to start the conversation about brains.
Right. You know, and as soon as you take something out of the context of its normal size, then it allows you to be more free in the way you interact with that. And so for me, when I think about the brain, a brain is a bunch of neurons. A healthy brain has lots of healthy connections between the neurons making up that brain. And the exact same thing is true on the macrocosm of our community. A healthy community is taking all of the individuals making up that community and having healthy connections between them. And so for me, you know, the metaphor is perfect and beautiful. But bottom line is, this is Bloomington. This is such a special community. And I just cracks me up every time I drive around and I see a brain on display, you know, and it just, you know, so for me, it's been fun. It's been interesting. For those who aren't too thrilled about the brains, don't worry. They're only there for 6 months and then they're gone. But in the meantime, this is the time of the brains and the graduates have been around with them. Again, the phone app game is fun. People came to the launch from St. Louis, Chicago, Fort Wayne, Terre Haute, Evansville, Ohio, Louisville, and that's just some of the people I knew about. So we're drawing people. We're definitely drawing some attention. We've had some international coverage. NPR has been excellent to us. You guys have been superb for us. The HT has been, oh my gosh, over the top in helping us do this project. Could never have done it without the HT saying, hey, what do you think of the idea? Hey, they're looking for sponsors. Hey, they're looking for artists. And soon they're going to put out, they're going to print in the paper the map of where all the brains are. Because right now that's the big mystery. Where are they? Anyway, we're doing geocaching. I mean, you know, we're open to whatever. It's really collaborative and community. Whatever people want to do in relationship to it, bring it on. We're having a great time. Happy to participate. Totally collaborative.
Wonderful. I think there are several groups out there who are going to be happy that you just said that. And I am curious.
We'll see what comes.
I am curious about the community response. But also the community support. I know that there's a lot of volunteers to put these out, but that you're also looking for, you know, the way you adopt a highway, like an adopt a brain. And
exactly.
Has that all been taken care of? And is there still something the community can do to kind of maintain these brains and make sure that they are in all their glory for the months that they're up?
We're still looking for monitors. If you're out and about in Bloomington, we're asking people to kind of say, well, I'm willing to monitor a brain and just go by it 3 times a week and you can, if there's a problem, let us know. And so there has been some abuse to the brain. Some has been more minor. Some has been more major. But we're finding out about it because of the monitors are willing to go and do that. So if you're out and about or you're willing or you work and there's a brain right outside your building and you're willing to touch base with us, just go and look at it and make sure that there hasn't been any damage. And if there is, then hook into jbtbrains.org. And so that we know know what's going on, because that's really how we're keeping tabs on them. And we're trying to keep keep up with the repair. We also have a volunteer repair team. So if you're good at being creative and coming up with solutions, then we're open for that too. And then of course in the fall when they all come down, we're going to need help at that point. So we'll put out an SOS for help for taking the exhibit down. So it's all very exciting, and we don't actually know what's going to happen with these brains after the fact. I don't know how much of a market there actually is for enormous brains. I think we'll probably find out. One of the brains will end up in my front yard on display, and I'm breaking my neighbors into that idea. So I think that'll be fun. But otherwise, I spoke with the woman who has taken globes, 5-foot globes, on tour around the planet, and she has something like 140 globes that actually go on exhibit. And so I've already had several communities approach me and say, we would love to have the brains. You know, how many are there? When might they be available? So that may be the future. And beyond that, though, I don't know if I really want to be in the business of big brains. That wasn't the point. But at the same time, we've created a model here. And so why not share that with other communities?
Absolutely. Well, then let's move on to your own future. Really quickly, because I know we're running out to the end of the hour, but I am interested in some of the other projects that you are involved in. I spoke about the Nintendo Wii. Obviously, to get to the question of the game that you are developing or working on, you yourself worked on a Nintendo math game.
Right.
That was one of the last things to come back was numbers. So how important is it to use this technology, and what are you thinking for your development?
Well, I definitely, I'm interested in creating tools that will help other people go through neurological recovery based on, I was fortunate that I had a roadmap in what did it feel like to be normal? What is the goal of feeling normal? And I want to give back that way. And I think through the use of video game is a great way to do that. Right now I'm at the stage of emptying my brain from the brain extravaganza. I'm back to skiing on Lake Monroe in order to help dissipate all those details. And, it's going to be a very creative time for me this summer in coming up with new ideas. I care about the school systems here. We're putting together a program where for the little kids, it can be paint your own brain. Blooming Foods has agreed to post these images of the colored brains by the little ones up. We had a night of 100 brains here for the older kids where we had 100 brains painted or drawn or something on exhibits for the gallery walk that happened on May 4th. It was wonderful. We walked around and looked at the 100 brains that the kids had done. So I really care about education and awareness in this community, and I'm open to possibilities. So send the information to Michael Shermis. That's all I can say. JVTBrains.org, and go to Michael. And because we are open to how do we work with the community in order to keep the momentum going and to really bring awareness, appreciation, and education for this beautiful thing inside of our heads.
Okay, and then my last question, you did mention that there is a movie in the works. Was there anything you can tell us about that?
All I can tell you is that on Friday I received a finished screenplay, so I'm reading it.
That's very exciting. Dr. Jill Bolte-Taylor, I cannot thank you enough for coming and stopping by and onto Interchange tonight and sharing your story. You have been listening to Interchange. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Thanks to our assistant producer, Shane Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by Lewis Malone, and the executive producer is myself, Allison Bechtesh. Our original theme music is by Jamil Effiam. Again, thanks for listening.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.